Select Committee met over the weekend to hear submissions on the Countering Terrorist Fighters Legislation Bill. The committee will sit again today to deliberate before reporting the bill back to the House tomorrow. It remains the government's intention to pass the bill before the House rises in the middle of next week. I just want to make a few points on this, given some of the public comment that's been made in recent days. The bill is moving through a fast process because the issue of foreign terrorist fighters is rapidly evolving and there are gaps in our law that need to be addressed. As I said in my national security speech a month ago, New Zealand's risk and threat profile is changing. ISIL has been successful in recruiting New Zealanders to its cause, and I've been as open as I can be about the threat without overstating it. Government agencies have a watch list of between 30 and 40 people of concern in the foreign fighter context. Another 30 to 40 require further investigation. The bill contains measures that can add to the safety and security of New Zealand in the short term, ahead of the more comprehensive review that has to begin by the middle of next year. We are listening to the concerns of submitters and we are engaging with other political parties in good faith about the bill. We have an open mind and it's entirely possible that the proposals will change before this is passed into law. But I need to be clear, I will not stand by and ignore advice from the security agencies about what they are seeing and put New Zealanders at greater risk. I take my responsibilities for national security very seriously. The government has a duty to ensure we do everything possible to ensure New Zealanders are safe at home and abroad, and I believe the bill in this regard helps. It may be useful at this point to provide an update on the coalition campaign to counter ISIL. You will recall that on the 3rd of November, Cabinet approved a Defence Force scoping team to explore options and gather information on a possible building partner capacity mission in Iraq. This would be a non-combat role. New Zealand would not lead any mission, but would be subject to invitation from the Iraqi government to participate in an Australia-led capacity building mission. We currently have four Defence Force staff in the region engaged in discussions with coalition counterparts. I'm told planning remains at a very early stage, with particular focus on the skills that would be required of trainers and the enabling support required for such a mission, including force protection, medical support and leadership. How all these elements would link in with the specific training requirements of the Iraqi security forces still need to be ascertained. The team in the region say the timetable for planning remains fluid. Current indications are the team may have sufficient information to provide advice to ministers in late January or early February on a possible New Zealand contribution to building partner capacity mission. As you know, today new drink driving laws come into effect. Both the blood and breath alcohol limits for motorists over the age of 20 have been lowered from 80 to 50 milligrams of alcohol per 100 millilitres of blood and from 400 to 250 micrograms of alcohol per litre of breath. For under 20-year-olds, it's still a zero alcohol limit. Penalties for breaking the limits include significant fines and demerit points, and drivers will lose their licence for repeat offending. Kiwis' attitudes to drinking and driving have improved tremendously over recent years, but there's still too many crashes and deaths on our roads. The lower alcohol limits will help make our roads safer and save lives. Just in terms of the House this week, the government intends to make progress on the Crimes Match Fixing Amendment Bill, the Public Safety Public Protection Orders Bill, and the Parole Extended Supervision Orders Bill. As I mentioned, the Countering Terrorist Fighters legislation will be reported back to the House tomorrow and Wednesday as a Members' Day. Finally, in terms of my own activities this week, I'll be in Wellington today, tomorrow and Wednesday. On Thursday, I have a number of visits and meetings in Auckland. On Friday, I'm travelling to Hamilton.
Prime Minister, so an ANZAC-style force in Iraq is likely, is it, or possible?
Well, look, I've seen the media reporting out of the Australian newspapers, and I'd say the way that's reported is fundamentally wrong, because it talks about a combat force. There will be no ANZAC combat force. But what is possible is that New Zealand joins up with Australia as part of a training capability. It's not impossible that they could be badged as an ANZAC unit. That is possible. But we're a long way away from sort of agreeing that. Firstly, the Australians haven't made a formal decision to go into undertaking training, neither have we. We haven't identified the place that we could train, and we certainly haven't made any decisions about a badged unit. But they certainly wouldn't be combat, they could be training if they took place.
Sure, so what are the benefits of a badged training ANZAC unit?
I think fundamentally just symbolic. I mean, you might remember some time ago that Kevin Rudd raised with me the issue of whether we could have an ANZAC badged unit. At the time we sort of said, yep, that's potentially possible. And one argument would simply be the symbolism of 100 years of commemorations for Gallipoli. So, look, it's a possible thing, but it would be working very closely together, obviously, if we did that together, but we'd be no more than that.
Because potentially the symbolism would obviously be huge because of, looking at the timelines you're talking about, it could be that an ANZAC badge training unit goes in sometime around the actual anniversary of Gallipoli.
That's right, that's possible. I mean, we are... You don't want to get ahead of ourselves. There's a lot of decisions that need to be made. Firstly, whether we absolutely will commit, whether the Australians will do that, whether we can find a location, and whether we want to do it on a badged basis. But I suspect that's what's driven the media reports, even though the characterising slightly the wrong way.
And you have talked with Tony Abbott about this in bilateral talks, obviously.
Yeah, so we've had a couple of, I'd say, you know, pretty high-level discussions about it. Just said, look, you know, is it possible? The answer is yes, it's potentially possible that we could have an ANZAC badge force, but it's really at that sort of high level. The primary discussions we had when we were in Australia some time ago were about committing to going, having a look together about the training capability. So we certainly didn't agree that it would be an ANZAC badge force, but we had those discussions.
And what would be the split on this? I mean, if we're talking about 400 troops?
Yeah, so it's very, very early days. Sort of submissions that I've seen are a slightly lower number than that, and proportionally New Zealand would obviously be considerably smaller, but all of those would have to be determined.
Are we talking maybe New Zealand could contribute up to 100 troops to this kind of thing?
It's, again, really early, but I mean, I think the numbers could range anywhere from sort of, you wouldn't be less than 40 and you probably wouldn't be more than 100, and Australia would be, you know, proportions higher.
And in terms of force protection, would that be done necessarily by regular defence force or by SAU?
Again, all of that hasn't been decided. I mean, what we would want to do and absolutely insure on doing is making sure that our trainers have the appropriate level of protection. And I think that could be undertaken by the regular forces or potentially SAS, or as I say, potentially a sort of even a badge sort of group made up of similar capable people. But it's very early days and we're looking at that.
So in terms of your desire to have a safe base for Kiwis to train on, does that still stand? Do you still want somewhere that can be flown in and out of? Is that?
Yes, and so they are the sorts of things that we, or conditions that we would set, and that's why our military people are looking at the situation. I mean, I think, you know, Iraq presents some real dangers if you don't undertake your training in the right way. You know, there's always risks of, you know, sort of suicide attacks, sort of IEDs that we saw in Afghanistan. We have to ensure that our people can get in safely and get out safely. We have to ensure that the base can be secured, and we have to ensure that there's proper protection of our people. It doesn't eliminate all the risks. I think, as we've discussed before, there are still inherently some risks there, but we can at least lower those risks.
Do you lose control over an exit strategy, though, if it becomes part of an ANZAC unit?
Well, they are the things we'd have to consider, because once it's a badge unit, you know, you're kind of in together and you're out together. And so, yes, that's a factor to weigh up. On the other side of the coin, there is both something symbolic, and our forces do train and operate together in lots of locations. And I think in terms of training, both of us have a sort of degree of sense of timetable of how long we would be there. But what's important to note is Australia could have a different response to ISIS from us. We've already seen them deploy their SAS. You know, we're not doing that unless we do it as part of our, you know, protection, for instance. So we wouldn't want to have a badged ANZAC group that was broader than the mandate that I outlined in my speech, because I think they are the parameters I'm comfortable with.
When's the last time we've had a badged force? Okay.
Well, I'm not sure they were ever actually badged when they went to Gallipoli. I'm not the great historian. I think they would just have the ANZAC name. That was the moniker that was put on them, but they weren't actually badged. I'm not sure we've had one, actually.
Unprecedented.
I think so, but we'd need to check that.
And is there any plan to extend that beyond this commitment into other...
No, I mean, I think we need to look and see whether this is possible.
So, read the legislation. What changes are you prepared to make to particularly perhaps get support of the Labour Party?
Yeah. So, look, as you're aware, it's going through the Select Committee at the moment, the legislation, so there's really a limit to what I can say without, you know, breaching the conditions that Select Committee operates under. But the most important thing I'd say is I personally would like to see the Labour Party support legislation if they can. I'm aware of the fact that they have discussed with the committee chair in writing a number of proposals that they'd like to see incorporated into legislation. And my understanding is the committee's working its way through those to see if we can accommodate, if not all of them, at least a decent number of them. So we certainly have gone in there with an open mind view. In the end, we'll pass the legislation if we have to, you know, with our support partners, but I'd very much like to do it with Labour if I can.
Why do you need Labour so badly?
Well, I just think that, you know, I think the New Zealand public can see that this is an issue that sort of is above politics. And in the end, this is about national security. It's a recognition that there are 30 to 40 people sitting on a list. There are people who are fighting for terrorist groups overseas. And I think it's a sign of unity, if we can, to demonstrate that we want to tackle that issue to protect New Zealanders together. Now, as I said, in the end, you know, as Prime Minister, I've got to make the call. If the Labour Party won't join with me, then I'll do it anyway because it's required. But, you know, my preference would be to work with them if we can.
Many of the submitters said that Australia and Britain are both taking much longer to consider more the legislation. Why did New Zealand rush it so quickly?
Yeah, so in the case of Australia and Britain are looking at changes, but my understanding of it is that Australia and Britain are going much further than we are. We've actually got a really quite a narrow setting on this. It's fundamentally about being able to cancel a passport for longer, having a temporary suspension of the passport, incorporating the search and surveillance capability of the Search and Surveillance Act within the SIS and looking at temporary non-warranted surveillance which needs a retrospective warrant. So in the case of the UK and Britain, it's a much broader setting. We might look at broader settings, but we would want to do that through a proper review of the legislation and a much longer Select Committee process, so that's the
business. Have there been any concerns about people's reports about a Muslim man, a Maori man in the Hawke's Bay setting up a Facebook page for the Islamic State of Aotearoa? I mean, is that the type of propaganda or type of thing that you're concerned about?
Well, I can't talk about one individual. I mean, I've seen the media reports and I really can't say much about that particular individual. But what I can say is there's no question that the people that are sitting on that group of 30 to 40 that we're looking at and others that we're starting to take interest in are getting propaganda delivered to them highly effectively through the internet. No doubt about that. So we can look at the sites that they're looking at, we can monitor the amount of time they're spending on those sites, and we know that they are very interested in the teachings that they're getting from those sites. And I think that's one of the really differences between ISIS and other terrorist groups. They're looking to have an outreach campaign which is unprecedented, they're highly, you know, well-funded, and they invoke local terrorism or domestic terrorism in the event that someone can't come and fight in the Middle East.
And is that why, though, you need more powers, because you're worried at the speed of which people are becoming interested in these types of terror groups?
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen over the course of the last, I think, 6 months or so, is quite an exponential increase in the number of people that are tapping into these social media sites, the number of people that are interested in the message from ISIS, and the potential threat that they face. We've also got the Cricket World Cup that we're co-hosting early next year, so if we don't pass the legislation by the time the House rises, it really won't be in place by the time we start the co-hosting. And I think we deliberately kept the boundaries of the proposed legislation very tight to take out the more controversial bits. It was with the intention of trying to get something that the Parliament, on a majority basis, could feel comfortable with.
And the 48 hours surveillance seems to be the big sticking point. Are you willing to water that down if you need to get Labour support?
Potentially, yes.
About a month ago, you said you were unlikely to pass the legislation if you couldn't get bipartisan support, but you made a comment just before which suggested you'd change your thinking on that.
Well, we're working really hard to get bipartisan support. I hope that the Labor Party will support us and take a responsible view to it, because I certainly, as Prime Minister, have to take a very responsible view to the security of New Zealanders. I think in the end, if they don't, on the basis of the advice I've had from the intelligence agencies, we'll press ahead and pass it.
So are you signalling that you expect
when there's this broader review that will actually result in even tougher provisions being brought in?
Well, I'm saying that would be a much broader, there'd be a greater opportunity to look at a broader range of initiatives and to potentially look much further than where we are at the moment. Whether it ultimately will result in different changes or simply codifying in legislation permanently the sorts of changes we're passing under the current provisions with the sunset clause, I don't know, it's too early to tell. But by definition, the reviews are much deeper and wider than what we're currently looking at.
So you could have a shorter period of time, say like 24 hours instead of
48
hours?
Yeah, I mean, look, that's always possible. And there's no question, if you look at the public commentary, because I can't talk about what's happening in the committee, but if you look at the public commentary, like the one area where you've seen some public unease, really, has been based around the 48 hours of unwarranted activity, albeit that requires retrospective warranting authority. And so I think that's the one area where I think potentially the government, well, there are other areas, but that might be one area where the government might be prepared to move.
And is it safeguard, you're talking about increased safeguards over that 48 hours or a reduction in the time?
Well, we'd have to wait and see, and we'd have to wait and see what the recommendations are from the Select Committee, but it's eminently possible the government could consider, for instance, more safeguards in a shorter period of time or more safeguards in the same period of time. We can mix and match that. But
just going back to the possible contribution to the efforts against the Islamic State, so the details of force protection are still under discussion. Is there still a possibility that we can see, for example, New Zealand infantry in a force protection role?
Look, I just don't have any details yet on what sort of level of protection would be used, other than it would obviously have to be appropriate to keep our men and women safe. So I really don't know. But we'll get some advice on that. What I do know is, while you could use the SAS in that role for force protection, you wouldn't necessarily have to, as the advice I've had from Defence.
But you could, you said before, you could send the SAS as well in some sort of joint unit.
No, what I mean is that would be part of that ANZAC training.
Yeah.
They could provide specialist protection around the base.
And is one of those issues protection on the base from green on blue or, from basically Iraqis killing New Zealand soldiers? Are you worried? You've worried about that?
Well, I think there's fundamentally two risks. One is the base being attacked somehow, so that's one issue. And the second is, sort of green on blue attacks where there's somebody that parades as wanting to train for the Iraqi army but actually is an ISIS supporter. They're always very difficult to identify, and you saw that in Afghanistan, the Australians lost 3 SAS soldiers from memory as a result of a green on blue attack. So it's very difficult to be 100% sure, but we can do a lot to try and minimise that risk.
And in terms of finding a base that you can go in and out of, have the New Zealand soldiers there actually managed to do that? Does this place exist, basically?
Haven't had any advice yet, but I'm pretty confident there would be places as a result of really the US efforts when they were there in the past.
Given the string of conflicts that Iraqi military personnel have been involved in over the last 30, 40 years, what can we possibly train? What can we?
Why will it work?
Sorry?
Why will it work?
What are we going to be training? What are the things we can teach Iraqis about?
I think it's a legitimate question to say, why will it make any difference now when there's been a lot of training undertaken in the past and hasn't necessarily been entirely effective? There's a range of views. I mean, one view that's certainly held is that while a lot of credence was given to the surge being the reason why ultimately there was success post about 2007, there's also a view that the Iraqi forces did get much stronger, and actually you saw the awakenings where the Sunni tribesmen changed sides. And so essentially I think some people are more optimistic that you can do effective training of Iraqi forces. I guess in the end it comes down to what can international forces and what can countries like New Zealand do with the support of the Iraqi government to do something to assist them to stand up to a terrorist group. We know that we don't want to put in combat troops, but maybe this is a way of assisting them. So we just have to work our way through that.
How can you be confident that, say, 40 to 100 New Zealand troops don't get drawn into combat?
Given part of their mandate that would be drawn up. So, I mean, I haven't seen any of this, but I remember when we sent the SAS, for instance, to Afghanistan, they always operate under a mandate, as they did when our forces were in Bamiyan, which sort of spells out what they can and can't do.
But didn't the SAS end up in combat role?
They were in a different role. They were essentially what I think under the new lingo would be described as advise, assist and accompany. So they were training the crisis response unit, but they had the capacity to go out and accompany them on those missions. It's quite different from this mandate.
Was any progress ever made on your proposal in 2008 to limit commercial crab pots on beaches like Omaha, which might be attracting sharks?
I don't know the answer to that, but I can find out the answer.
Is that something you're still concerned
about? Someone probably spent a couple of days at Omaha over Christmas. Yeah, I'm interested in it. Well, look, there are plenty of fishermen who would disagree with me, but all I can tell you is the activity that I saw of people throwing out, you know, a lot of burley, I just find it hard to believe it doesn't attract sharks, but, you know, in the end, there may be wiser heads than me, but I'll have to go look and see what the advice showed.
On climate change, is the government considering new measures to help reduce emissions for the methane spill next year?
Do you mean in terms of what we might take to Paris? Or
yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well, at the core of it, we haven't seen the paper from Tim Grosser yet, but in the early part of next year, I expect him to bring a paper to Cabinet, which will spell out what we believe is the right negotiating framework to take to Paris, and what sort of overall commitment New Zealand would have. And I think I've signalled some campers when we speak to Federated Farmers and others, that we are looking really closely at the issue around methane and nitrate, for instance, and their emissions vis-a-vis, for instance, CO2, which we know CO2 is in the atmosphere a lot longer. And so we think there isn't an argument there about how that might be positioned in Paris.
Has New Zealand come under pressure from other parts of the world, particularly around the UN vote to try and improve its climate change emissions?
There'll always be countries that have a range of views, and certainly individual organisations that have a range of views, but I certainly haven't in terms of the international meetings I've attended.
Can I just ask you in relation to those
two-tier targets? Are you thinking of or suggesting a two-tier target, one for all greenhouse gases and another more ambitious one for CO2 alone? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I think we're in early days, but there is a sort of view held that because nitrogen and methane stays in the atmosphere for a much shorter period of time, I think it's much called toxic, it stays there for a much shorter period of time, and because the world needs to continue to produce food, it's about 14% of the emissions come from methane and nitrate. There is an argument that says maybe we just handle that differently to the way that CO2 is handled. I mean, in the end, my own view remains very consistent, which is we need to find scientific solutions, and I think the world won't accept a reduction in food production, even if it challenges us from a climate change perspective. So we're going to have to find a way through that.
Can I just ask you in relation to those heads of cameras, just following on from that, do you have any reason to believe whether he records phone calls with you?
I have absolutely no idea.
Have you had any phone conversations with him?
None since the Nicky Hager book came out.
Would you be worried if he were to release the transcripts of any of those conversations?
No, I don't think so.
On a more substantive
couldn't have put it in myself, but
on the issue of getting back to a surplus, so you have the final estimates for the issue, haven't you?
Yes, today.
And is it pointing to...
Well, I don't want to spoil the thunder of the Minister of Finance. I mean, I think you saw his comments over the weekend, and I mean, I think it's fair to say that the reduction in dairy prices and the modelling that shows from the Treasury is clearly having some impact, but the Minister of Finance remains confident that surplus for 2014-15. You guys all good?
Yeah.
Okay.